it seems like a simple question, but it's a really complex and important one. A lot of scholarship now is being done on these sorts of relationships, and I think a lot of issues in terms of university governance are being worked, people are attempting to resolve them around the use of Twitter and Facebook and these sorts of things. I consider my use of Twitter ever since I got onto the platform as something I do on personal time, and it's not something that I consider has a bearing or an influence or effect on my scholarship. Some people have used sort of Twitter and Facebook to kind of become social media celebrities, so to speak, but it's not my understanding or experience that a lot of them have been academics. It's a platform that allows people, academics in this case, to engage political issues using a completely different language than they normally use in their scholarship and at academic conferences and these sorts of things. It's definitely more unfiltered. It's definitely more spontaneous and free-flowing. But the AAUP and lots of other groups have been firm in their conceptualization of social media as falling under the category of extramural utterances. I know that some academics have published scholarly papers about Twitter and Facebook and these sorts of things, but I'm actually not much familiar with that scholarship, so I can really only speak to my personal use of the platform, and that's just something that I kind of do for fun, for engagement, for conversation, and in a weird sort of way for community, right? Social media is an interesting way to find community. I've met a lot I know a lot of fantastic people on social media that I don't think I've ever met in person, which I think is something that came into existence with the advent of email. But it would be my opinion that academics, students, otherwise, be free to tweet without fear of retribution, without fear of punishment. But if universities are going to begin considering tweets and Facebook and blogs, et cetera, as part of somebody's scholarly credentials, then they need to write that into their governance and make it explicit from the get-go, right? Otherwise, if it were just based on social media, I'd have like 6 endowed shares right now. I think they need to be very clear from the outset, right, about what counts as part of one's scholarly dossier, right, and what's considered extramural, and that which is considered extramural ought to be protected by academic freedom.
My name is Mark Coleman. I am a Zionist. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I drove 5 hours here. On my way over, among other things, I listened to your radio program on This Is Hell, Northwestern, and on the basis of that, I changed a lot of my remarks. I'll try to be brief within the 2 minutes. The thing that changed my mind is when you had said that you are not an expert on Judaism, you are not an expert on anti-Semitism, that you wanted to have a cool-down period, and that you specifically did not want to blame Jewish donors because you did not want to play into an anti-Semitic trope of the Jews holding the purse strings. And I wanted to try to provide my point of view in terms of education, specifically in terms of indigeneity. This is the second column from the Dead Sea Scrolls of Qumran. I'm not an archaeologist, but it's very familiar to me. The lettering is the same as that on the tombstones of my grandparents, my great-grandparents. I've been reading, just as I read the scrolls of my bar mitzvah, when it says, Ki mitzion teitzei tovah u'dvar Hashem mi Yerushalayim, that the word of Hashem comes from Mount Zion in Jerusalem. And when it says, the nation will not lift sword against nation and there will be peace. This is the essence of my Judaism. Mm-hmm. I don't call myself a Jew. The term Jew is a European term from 1,000 years ago. I'm a Yehudi. Just like a Cherokee or a Maori, I'm a member of the Yehudi tribe. My tribe is indigenous to Israel, West Bank, Gaza, and parts of Jordan. That's where we're from. I don't need to get any validation from you or anyone else. But if you want to say that you're an expert in indigenous studies, you need to understand the indigenous nature of the Jewish people. We are not just people of the book. Our book is the book of a people. Now, our people needed to make the nation state. The nation state is a terrible thing.
Sir, can you please get to your point, because we have other...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry for running over. My point is this, that there are other anti-Semitic tropes that you play into. And one of the worst ones is the blood libel, that Jews would kill children and drink their blood. And when you say that...
Well, let the gentleman finish. Okay. All right. Let's.
Obviously not. Of course he didn't say it. What he did say is that if you do not criticize Israel, then you are okay with the wholesale slaughter of children. I support Israel, but I am not okay with the slaughter of children. My point is, slaughter, the first definition of slaughter is to kill
children. We're going to have Dr.
Feldman
keep a 2-minute limit so we can maximize the amount of voices.
Okay. Mr. Feldman, is that your name? Yeah. Well, I'm honored, first of all, that you came up all the way from Cleveland. And I'd be happy to chat more, you know, online or in person outside of the confines of this forum. My definition of indigeneity is quite different than yours, and I'm not a fan of inscribing a form of ethno-nationalism on scripture, basically, right? I mean, we could get into all kinds of questions about people's bloodlines and what genetic tests reveal, but the fact of the matter was the Palestinians were there, Palestine was a nation, 750,000 of them got dispossessed, and now, right, their land is being settled, and a significant number of them exist under military occupation. And this is hard for me to say because I feel like it's important for me to have respect for your sense of morality. But after Operation Protective Edge and so many things that had happened before it, I would say that it's impossible to support Israeli policy without also implicitly supporting the deaths of those children. The two things go together. I don't feel like you can separate them. It's those policies of the state that led to the deaths of those children, the murder of those children, if you wanted me to use stronger language. But we have a very profound and fundamental disagreement, first of all, about the notion of indigeneity, and second of all, how that notion of indigeneity can inform a particular form of ethno-nationalism. There's plenty of evidence to suggest, plenty of evidence, and I don't like to call upon it because I don't think it's useful in making a political argument. We're going to go down that road. There's plenty of evidence to suggest, genetic evidence, historical evidence, that today's Palestinians are the descendants of the ancient Jews of the Bible, right? So, you know, if we're going to go down that road, then there are all kinds of possibilities. But I don't see how a proclamation that one group of people, which is being oppressed, is deserving of a nation state at the expense of the sovereignty and the freedom of another people.
As a professor of American Indian Studies, I was wondering if you could talk just briefly about the parallels, if any, that you see between the experience of Palestinian people and Native American people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll try. And when I say I'll try, I really mean to say I'll try not to yammer for about 30 minutes. I'll try to keep it reasonable. Let me start with differences. They're extraordinary. Can everybody hear me okay, or do I? Okay. How's this? Okay. Keeps dropping and dropping on me. There are extraordinary differences, among Native nations and Palestinians. Where I find the similarity is in a particular discourse of colonization that draws from Old Testament narratives to rationalize settlement and conquest. We go back to a lot of the Puritan settlers in North America, particularly in the Northeast. They write of the natives they encounter as the nation of Amalek, right? And then they describe them as Canaanites. Cotton Mather, the Puritan firebrand, was especially famous for doing that sort of thing. So they conceptualized very explicitly, and in many cases, my reading of Cotton Mather, for example, is that he's not being allegorical, right? That he's being sincere. They conceptualize themselves as Israel in the wilderness, right? And the natives as the Amalekites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, etc. Basically, the Holy Land tribes, right, who were there in the land of Canaan, right, when, as described in the book of Joshua, God commanded the Israelites to cross the River Jordan, right, and basically slaughter the indigenous tribes. All right, and that was the framework that a lot of settlers in early settlers, especially in North America, used. Well, if you go back to Palestine, a few centuries later, you see this particular discourse of godly conquest get reinvoked as a justification for political praxis, as a justification for colonization. So basically, if you want to be really, really crude about it, the Palestinians and natives are the unfortunate, unchosen ones in the Old Testament narrative, right? They're the ones to whom nothing has been promised by God, right? Except displacement, except a secondary citizenship, absent of conversion, right? To the dominant religion. That was particularly relevant in North America. And now I'm beginning to note some connections in the discourses of decolonization. There are significant moves to I don't like to use the word accommodate, let's say, to explore Palestine, right, as a site of study in Native American studies or indigenous studies, whatever you want to call it. And part of the reason for that is because there's been, over the past 10, 15 years, a lot of on-the-ground activism between the two communities and a lot of scholarly interchange between the two communities. There's more than two communities. I'm talking about hundreds of communities, but you get my gist, I hope. So I think the connections can be boiled down to biblical narratives of conquest and settlement, being the colonized party, working against the notion that they were destined for displacement or that they have no other historical choice but displacement, and then finally the fact that the United States and Israel are so close, not just politically and economically, but psychically, that in many ways they're dealing with the same colonial entity. And you're talking about the problem of universities being beholden to money. Okay. It's a terrific question, and I feel like whatever answers I give are in some way going to be inadequate because there's I think so much to think about in the context of how universities function. So I welcome others of you to join in and include whatever it is that I inevitably forget. I mean, the easiest solution, I suppose, would be to run universities as sites of education and not as corporations, right? That's now, how we get to that point, I don't know, because I think a lot of problems intersect here, right? One of them is the university playing a role as a functionary of state power, right? The ethos of the university, the governance of the university, the funding of the university, et cetera, as I guess a space wherein state power is reinforced rather than challenged. And this is a problem of universities goes back a long way. Universities have long been complicit in the United States and elsewhere with state violence. Thinking about Harvard in the 1950s vis-a-vis the nuclear bomb, and you know Henry Kissinger's. I keep going back to Harvard. I don't know, but it does make it sort of a terrific example. But a lot of other universities do too. So the universities have long been implicated in practices of state violence, not only in functional ways, right, in technical ways, but in discursive ways also, right, as you know, moral and philosophical justifications for the supremacy of a certain type of thought or politic. Other things go into it. It's the lack of state funding for public institutions, right? So as they begin to rely more and more, on private funding, they have more of an impetus or a need to appease the private donors that are giving them money. And these are very often corporate donors, right? And when your institution is being then you know you're going to have a very limited framework in which you're able to work before the funding goes dry. But it's also a problem, I think, of the student as consumer model. I think that has a lot to do with it. Also, the student as paying customer, the preponderance of athletic cultures on a lot of big universities, right? And I'm a college sports fan. I'm a complete hypocrite here. Okay, I'll be the first to admit it, right? I watch college sports. I feel guilty while I do it, if that makes a difference, right? But I watch them. But these athletic the corporate sponsorships, these sorts of things, mean that universities place a tremendous emphasis on branding. You hear universities often discuss their brand, my brand this, my brand that, the university's brand, and athletics, of course, are a great way for universities to promote their brand, which has something of an unquantifiable value. I think all of these things come to bear on it. You could also include, I would include, the huge reliance now on contingent labor, right? The tremendous mistreatment of, for lack of a better phrase, blue-collar labor on campuses, juxtaposed with not only ballooning administrative salaries, which are just remarkable. We're talking, deans are making $250,000, $300,000 now, in liberal arts deans, right? We're talking about upper level administrators, getting $500,000 plus, and it's not just their salaries, but their numbers. Their numbers are increased. We're having the university's uploaded basically with more and more administrators making more and more money, right? Whereas those folks who work for the physical, those folks who are slaving 4 to 5 classes a semester, right, are getting paid less. They're not having access to proper medical insurance. They can get fired on a whim. These sorts of things. I try to always keep that in mind, because I think what's so shocking about my termination is that I was terminated from a tenured position, but people in worse circumstances than I are getting let go all the time, and they don't necessarily have any legal recourse, right? But they're more or less powerless in this situation. I'm yammering, but I think all of these things, we have to think about all of these things as a reality of the modern university if we're going to think about ways to create spaces of education that value the human over the product. And I think that seems to me a huge problem with it. I don't like the idea of the student as consumer or the student as customer. I like to think of students as human beings, right? And human beings for whom an education, a proper education, will be absolutely invaluable, its value will be incalculable, right? And so I think it's important to look at the university structure in the context of the broader state structures of inequality in which it exists and which it reinforces, if that makes any sense. Okay. Oh, wow. You've opened Pandora's box. That's my pet peeve, and I've been complaining about that verbally and sometimes in print for quite a while. I think the terms diversity and multiculturalism, first of all, are terms that come out of the private sector. They're corporate terms. All right, they didn't originate on college campuses. Right, they came out of HR departments in private companies. Well, okay, I can imagine some of you are thinking, so what's the problem with that? Well, because universities aren't supposed to be corporations, right? And I think that they're supposed to hold themselves to a higher standard of inquiry. And I find the problems of the language of multiculturalism and diversity troublesome, primarily because they do nothing on their own. All right, it's individual advocates notwithstanding. On their own, they do nothing or very little to challenge structures of racism and sexism and inequality. Right, they are asking us to they're asking us to appreciate difference and to tolerate difference, but they're not asking us why difference is hierarchized in particular ways, right? And who benefits from those hierarchies and you know, who loses from those hierarchies. I also don't like its emphasis on tolerance, right? I think tolerance is a horrible term to use, right? It basically says that you know, you can kind of sort of grudgingly accept my existence here. You'll tolerate me, right? But it doesn't put people on an equal footing. It just doesn't, right? The individual or the group who's in a position to extend the olive branch of tolerance automatically has more power. That's just the way it works. So I find that troublesome. But also, multiculturalism and diversity, and I'm talking about them as discourses, right? As ideals, that's something different, right? I'm talking about them as discourses in the university campus, right? And as practices, I guess. They generally overlook or consciously ignore issues of class, right? They very much elide issues of proper minority retention or the retention of ethnic minorities as students and faculty. And it really tries to paper over using very, very vague, cheerful terminology, structural problems that would require actual resources, right, and actual hard work, right, in order to begin to identify and begin the process of eliminating them. And I've been in plenty of universities as a student or as a teacher or as a guest or whatever, and I don't know about Northwestern. I can only talk to my experiences, but everybody grumbled when I said that. Okay, I guess that's my answer. But I heard like the sigh audibly. You know, it's like when somebody misses a field goal. You know, it's like anyway. How many universities, right? Just like how many corporations are going to beat the drum around diversity and inclusiveness while doing not a damn thing, right, to actually improve the conditions, right, of those who are considered diverse populations. The University of Illinois, for example, this is a bad word, but it's the one that's popping into my mind, and let me apologize in advance for it, but it's hemorrhaging. I can't even pronounce it correct. It's losing black students at a remarkable rate. And then they're prattling on and on and on about diversity and inclusiveness and blah, blah, blah. The American Indian Studies is featured on its web page, Inclusive Illinois, right? So they're happy to feature it, while at the same time they're treating the American Indian Studies program like crap, right? And so at base there's a huge difference between discourse and action. But you begin to notice over time that the discourse comes to tacitly describe the conscious lack of action, and therefore we have to look at the discourses themselves.
Wider issue having to do with the attempt to silence dissent in this country. In light of your losing your home, your career's shattered, do you think that maybe it would be advisable to shut up and just not make waves?
Okay. Well, thank you. I agree with you that this is that exists in the larger context of the stifling of dissent, right? You know, there's been a lot of work done on how a narrow view of politics has to become self-regulating, right? In Western industrial democracies, and the same thing is true in microcosmic form on college campuses. As to Stephen Cohen, is that who it was? Stephen Cohen's admonishment that we be quiet. I'll try to answer the question of whether graduate students or for that matter established faculty ought to just keep and. It's a nearly impossible question for really is. I've seen what can happen if you upset the wrong people or I guess speak too strongly about a particular issue. But I've also known that this sort of thing has happened to people in the past as well. I know that this sounds like a cop out, but I mean it very sincerely. I think that it's a deeply personal decision that people have to make. You know, it would be easy for me to say, no, everybody, raise your voice, raise it loudly, and who cares if, what the consequences are, and if you do anything less than that, then you lose some of my respect. I don't think it's that simple. A lot of ethnic minorities, especially, just getting into academe, right? It can be troublesome enough, and the internal politics that they have to deal with can be a full-time job, right? Above and beyond the other jobs. The diversity faculty, right? The token diversity faculty, right? Takes up an extraordinary amount of time, And if you don't know what the token diversity faculty is, the minority in the department or the few minorities in the department get stuck on tons of committees because they need representation of women or people of color or whatever the case might be. So, it's a complicated question, but I feel like if one wants to raise her voice, one is confident in speaking on a particular issue that's controversial, then one should do it, right? That person ought to also be aware of the power dynamics at play and realize that it's never an individual decision, right? I have a young son at home. I have who needs to be fed and cared for. I have a spouse. I have parents to aging parents to think about. So there's a lot reliant on. I guess my employment that goes beyond just me and so, I people ought to think about these things, but I don't think anybody who's ready to speak or who wants to speak or raise her voice in any particular way, right, needs to be quiet simply for the sake of fear. And I would also suggest that there are ways to be active, to work for change, that don't necessarily involve being public, right? You don't have to run your mouth on Twitter like I did, right? You don't have to keep putting up public Facebook statuses. You don't have to write for Electronic Intifada, right? You don't necessarily have to do any of those things. I like doing these things. I do these things, right? But for some people, it could be labor organizing. It can be helping get a union on a non-unionized campus. It can be working on issues of retention and job placement for minority grad students. There are lots of ways, in other words, to be active in this struggle without necessarily being public about your advocacy. We have to think creatively. But I don't think And not that you were suggesting this. I'm not putting this on you, just as a general principle. I don't think it's that others speak up against something if that's something that they don't feel comfortable doing in any particular moment.
I really feel like that question and your answer sort of begs another question, and it's for all of us. Like, when somebody steps forward and says what you're saying, you know, the truth, moral clarity, and calls out war, you know, injustice, oppression of a whole people, the way that you did, and then you're attacked like this, it's on all of us to come to your defense. So it's not enough just to say that not everybody has to do exactly what I did, but I think it's on all of us for when this happens that we have to step forward, and we have to defend you. We have to thank you for your courage and your clarity for standing strong, and we have to continue to support you and demand justice, that you get your job back. You're able to actually.
That's extremely kind of you to say thank you, but this isn't false modesty. I wouldn't expect or want anybody to thank me, right? I chose to do what I did, and I'm even right now sitting here happy with the decision, and I should say that the way that people have supported me has been remarkable, right? It's been absolutely remarkable, and I don't even know what to say except, you know, as hard as it's been in lots of ways, and I think it's been particularly hard on my immediate family, but as hard as it's been, it's made me more hopeful than I've ever been. It's made me really, really happy to be alive. You know?